Chapter 4. Djebe rolled onto his face and pushed himself to his knees. His armor was covered in scorch marks and dull gray patches where the color had been stripped from it by his fall down the slope. He had held on to his sword, despite everything. That was some comfort, though not as much as he'd hoped. The explosion that had consumed the whirlwind had hurled him down the slope, and he felt every meter of that journey in his limbs and skull. Snow spun in lazy circles about him, and smoke boiled down off Rime Crag. He used his sword to lever himself to his feet. His power armor had absorbed the brunt of the whirlwind's demise, but the flesh of his face felt raw, and there was blood on his gorget. The air tasted foul as well, and for a moment he found himself wishing that he'd worn his helmet. Angrily he pushed the thought aside. His calm did not wear one, so the champion would not. That was the way of it. He was the Khan's will, the company's will made manifest. Above him he heard the whine of servos and pistons, and saw the massive outline of the alien battlesuit move through the smoke and the flames. He could hear the dull boom of bolter fire. Someone was still alive up there, and fighting. Somewhere below him, snow crunched. Djebe turned. Lightly armored Tau warriors were moving up the slope towards him. Pathfinders was what the Imperial briefing had called them. He hadn't been listening closely. Djebe didn't see much point in naming something that had been as good as dead the moment it set foot on an Imperial world. The red beams of several Markalites played across his battered armor, and he grimaced. His hand darted for the bolt pistol holstered on his hip, only to find the holster empty and tattered from the explosion. He didn't waste his breath on a curse. Instead, he whirled and sprinted up the slope. Behind him, the night was lit up with pulse bursts. They struck the slope all around him as he pushed his battered body to its limits. If he could reach the ridge, the smoke and flame would guard him from being shot down like a dog. And he'd get to fight something worthy of his blade. His eyes locked on the bulk of the alien battlesuit as it stalked through the smoke and snow. That was prey worthy of the champion of the third. The smoke enfolded him like a mother's arms. The ridge was covered in debris. Flames rippled through the air, streaking the night. He could smell spilled blood and oil. Broad shapes flickered eerily through the smoke, like hunting beasts following a scent. They were moving in pursuit of three of his brothers, one of whom was being dragged or carried between them. They fired at their pursuers, but between the snow, the smoke, and the shimmering camouflage of the latter, their shots went wild. Djebe lifted his blade to his lips and kissed it lightly. Then he began to hunt the hunters. They had no idea he was there. They were too intent on the limping, straggling figures ahead of them. When he struck them, it was without warning, and with every ounce of speed he could muster. His sword chopped into metal as his boot snapped out and up, catching a second Xenos in the chest. Armor buckled as the alien fell, and Djebe tore his sword free and sent it slashing out to catch a third hunter in the shoulder. He ducked under the latter's burst cannon as it flailed out at him, and grabbed it as he bobbed to his feet. He reversed his sword and slid it into the hunter's chest as the burst cannon began to fire. He jerked the body around so that the fusillade caught the remaining hunters. As the last of them sank down, wreathed in smoke, he ripped his sword free and let the body fall. He looked at his brothers. There were three of them, one supported between the other two.
"Running like whipped curs, brothers. Is that how the warriors of the Star Hunt act?"
"It is when we're the ones being hunted,"
one of the Space Marines said matter-of-factly.
"We were regrouping with haste."
He had lost his helmet, and the scars on his face stood out against his soot-blackened flesh, as did the gleaming metal campaign studs that lined the side of his skull. He carried a power glaive loosely in his free hand, and by its condition it had seen much use.
"We do not need to regroup," Djebe said. "The Khagan once said, be the center of every engagement, and victory will come on wings of smoke and wind."
"We were being the center,"
the other White Scar said. He jerked his head in the direction they'd been going. He carried a battered bolter, its sling wrapped tight around his forearm. Polished bones and golden bells dangled from cords threaded through holes punched in his gorget.
We were just going to be it over there, behind cover.
Jebe made to argue the point, when an energy burst skidded across his shoulder plate. He whirled about and saw the pathfinders approaching through the flames and smoke. The heavy shape of a large cylindrical drone floated above them, its weapons oscillating. He looked back at the others.
Over there, you say?
Semaka bit back a groan as Tolui pried the fang of burnt metal out of his belly. Blood pumped around the wound and then quickly began to coagulate. Semaka resisted the urge to touch it and said,
"How bad, boy?
Remember when that gene stealer bit you?"
"Vividly,"
Semaka said. They were hunkered behind a section of wreckage from the Razorback. Tolui had managed to angle the vehicle at the last moment so that the blast had struck its side rather than its front, sparing them the worst of it. Even so, the blast had been strong enough to tear the Razorback apart and knock what was left off the ridge and down the slope. Flames crackled nearby, and the falling snow turned to steam before it reached the ground, thanks to the heat radiating from the wreckage.
"Worse than that," Tolui said. "Do you feel like you're dying?"
"I wouldn't know,"
Semaka said. He levered himself up onto his elbows.
"How many survived?"
He could hear bolter fire above them, and the comm bead in his ear crackled. Someone was still fighting. That meant they had a chance, however slight.
"Enough to make them wish they'd killed us all first pass," Tolui said.
His helm was dented and scorched free of paint, and one of his eye lenses was cracked. From the smell, Semaka suspected that the helmet had been melted to his driver's face. Tolui gave no sign that he was in pain, and Semaka decided not to ask. Tolui had never been what one could call attractive anyway.
"I salvaged the portable Vox unit."
He hefted the boxy communications pack.
"Good. Keep at it," Semaka grunted,
as he grabbed hold of the smouldering wreckage and began to pull himself to his feet. Pain rippled through him, but he pushed it down. Pain was just a reminder that he still had a job to do. When it stopped, well, that was when it stopped mattering.
"I'll buy you what grace I can."
Tolui grabbed him.
"Given that my legs still work, what say I lead the dance, old man?"
"My legs still work," Semaka spat. "Besides, I hate those things. I can never get them to work,"
he gestured plaintively.
"Give me a bolter or a knife or something, anything," he said.
He tasted blood and hawked a gobbet of something dark onto the ground. Tolui handed him the Vox unit. Semaka sighed and slid back down.
"Fine,"
he grunted. He glared at Tolui.
"If I survive this, I'll have your skull mounted on my back."
"That's the spirit,"
Tolui said. He rose into a crouch.
"I'll be back directly."
"Take your time," Semaka said. "I'll just beat any enemies who come along to death with this hunk of uselessness."
He patted the Vox unit. He watched Tolui creep through the smoke and then looked at the Vox unit. It squawked at him, and he grimaced.
"Oh, where are you, Khwarezmian? Never around when your brothers need you," he growled.
He fumbled with the device, trying to pick up a frequency. They were still being jammed. The Tau had done a good job. He leaned his head back, his mind suddenly awash with pain. Space Marines were built to die slowly, by increments, rather than all at once. It was unseemly to go too quickly into the howling dark. After all, if you died too quickly, the Tech Brothers couldn't cram you into one of their boxes. He shuddered slightly, thinking of the Ghost Warriors. Being interred in the sarcophagus of a dreadnought was at once a high honor, reserved for only the mightiest warriors, and a fate that no White Scar would wish on a brother of the Ordu. To never feel the wind or the thrum of engines again was a horrifying thing. He looked around him, taking in the wreckage. A wave of sadness washed over him. As an aspirant, he had hoped to be called to the harness and hydraulics of the Tech Brothers to commune with the machine spirits. Instead, he had taken another path. But in his twilight, he had been allowed to move as he wished, and he had become a master of tanks. The purr of the great engines had been his balm, and as welcome as the voices of old friends. He had ridden with them into battle after battle. They were as close to him as any Hunt brother. He touched a chunk of twisted metal.
"I am sorry, my friend," he muttered.
He closed his eyes. When he opened them, a shadow had fallen over him. He looked up. The battle suit loomed over him like death incarnate, stinking of spilled fuel and burning metal. How had it got so close without him hearing it? The lens in the center of its square head whirred and clicked as it focused on him. Semaka eyed it and hefted the Vox unit in a considering fashion. Then, with a grunt, he tossed the device aside. He looked up at the battle suit.
"Well, I haven't got all day," he said.
The battle suit raised the cannon-like weapon that occupied its left arm, and he heard the sound of it cycling up to fire. He spat again and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. He waited. The construct hesitated, as if listening to some voice only it could hear. It began to lower its weapon. A chill coursed through Semaka's heart as he caught sight of the slowly advancing Tau warriors moving towards him from below, weapons at the ready. Not death, then, but captivity.
"Oh, that won't do," he muttered,
marshalling what remained of his strength. For a White Scar, captivity might as well have been death. If you couldn't get free, you died in the attempt. He began to push himself to his feet. The Tau paused, startled by his sudden movement.
"Yes, that's right, I can stand," he said conversationally.
His words carried easily through the cold air.
"No weapons to speak of, and I can taste death at the back of my throat. But I still stand. I still live."
He flexed his hands. Beneath his gauntlets, his knuckles popped. He looked up at the battle suit.
"There's a saying on Chigorus. Keep a dying tiger at lance's length."
He grinned.
"You got too close."
Semaka leapt, hands outstretched. The battlesuit reacted predictably. It swept out one massive arm and swatted him from the air, as he'd expected. He was sent tumbling down the slope, things ground together within him. He caught hold of the ground, digging his fingers in deep, and halted his slide. Everything hurt, but better a quick pain than the long agony of captivity. He shoved himself up.
"Once or twice more, I think,"
he coughed, blood speckling his beard and moustaches.
"No more than that. I'm an old man, after all."
He staggered towards the Tau, balling his hands into fists. He chuckled as targeting lights squirmed across his torso.
"Call the tune, fish bellies. I haven't got all day."
Snow swirled around him, momentarily obscuring the enemy. His wounds had opened again, and he could feel blood filling the crannies and crevices of his armor.
"Oh, this is a good death," he thought.
He had always suspected he would die amongst the burning ruins of his beloved battle tanks. He had always hoped to die thus. The snow cleared. The enemy had not moved, but a new element had been added to the tableau. Jebe crouched on the wreckage, a bandolier of grenades dangling from one hand and his sword in the other. The champion leapt onto the battlesuit and swung the bandolier about its head, activating the grenades as he sprang to the ground. He was in amongst the Tau a moment later, his first blow shearing through the large drone and his next dispatching a Tau. Jebe moved with the wind, and the edge of his blade was the curve of a crimson whirlwind. The grenades exploded, and the battlesuit teetered, smoke boiling from its orifices. Jebe ignored it, concentrating on the Tau. His sword swept out. There was a brutal poetry to Jebe's war dance, a sinuous music that was made known in the rasp of steel on flesh, in the crackle of the sword's power cell, in the dull thunder of explosions, and the screams of the dying. In the moment between sword strokes, Jebe was the truest heir to the legacy of the Great Khan and the Star Hunt personified. No movement was wasted, no wrong step taken. Every gesture was lethal. The air was filled with the foul blood of the Xenos, and they died one by one, barely able to register the strikes which punctured their chests or removed limbs. Jebe ceased his dance abruptly. Tau fell all around him, dead or dying. He moved towards Semaka, as the latter sank to his knees, one hand on his side.
"Easy, old man," Jebe said. "You will not die this day."
"Oh, will I not?" Semaka croaked. "What a shame. I was looking forward to the rest."
He gestured.
"The big one is still on its feet."
A missile snarred out of the snow and struck the reeling battlesuit. It toppled backwards with all the grace of a felled tree. The slope shook beneath the impact. Jebe sniffed.
"No, it's not."
He hooked Semaka's arm and guided him to his feet. Behind him, Semaka saw Tolui and two others loping forward, cradling weapons scavenged from the wreckage. One of the newcomers had an obviously wounded battle brother slung over his shoulder. Tolui cradled a missile launcher that had seen better centuries.
"Found them," he said.
He held up the missile launcher.
"And this," he added.
"So I see," Semaka grunted.
He looked at Tolui.
"Hasik," he said.
"No sign of him or his riders," Tolui said. "They must have got through."
"Or they're dead," Jebe said.
An ear-splitting whine pierced the air, interrupting any reply Semaka might have made. A second battlesuit crashed to the ground, near the wreck of the first, and unleashed a burst of fire from its cannon. Semaka shoved Jebe aside, and the barrage struck the section of wreckage behind them, sending it pinwheeling. The white scars scrambled for cover, firing their weapons. Bolters roared, and the battlesuit advanced towards them through the storm of explosive shells, as if they were no more substantial than the falling snow. The shield on its left arm sparked and shimmered as it absorbed the incoming fire. It pursued them up the slope, driving them before it. Its burst cannon became a blur of death, filling the air with lethal hornets of explosive energy. Jebe's sword sparked and rang as he blocked several of the shots and was knocked back several steps for his pains. Semaka coughed and clawed his way up the slope. Things were no better on higher ground. Tolui and the others had taken cover amongst the burning wreckage on the ridge. The gutted hulk of the Yasugai's teeth and the rhino that had been the object of its demise formed a makeshift bulwark. Jebe was the last up the slope. The battlesuit followed them slowly, apparently content to herd them back. Another battlesuit appeared at the other side of the ridge.
"Form up, brothers," Jebe said. "Stockade formation. Prepare to repel assault," he added.
He took a bolt pistol from one of the others and shoved it into Semaka's hands.
"You as well, old man," he said.
Semaka checked the clip and looked around. The broad shapes of more hunters, armor shimmering and fading out of sight, trudged forward through the snow. The two battlesuits waited, watching the white scars with the patience of well-fed predators. They'd beaten the other by catching it off guard. These two were ready, and surrounded by more shield drones. And, advancing up the slope, were more pathfinders, more drones, and more vehicles. The swiftest forces the Xenos had at their disposal, pitted against the riders of Chogoris.
"Keep the army together," I said, he said. "Don't go herring off after ghosts," I said. "But do they listen?" "Do they? Of course they don't. Who listens to the old man? Nobody, that's who, he growled.
What are you gnashing your teeth about, old man? Jebe muttered, not taking his eyes off the enemy.
The lack of wisdom among my peers, Semaka grunted.
What?
I said, I wonder what they're waiting for, he said. We're outnumbered, exposed, and bloodied. Why haven't they killed us?
Jebe glanced at him. The champion made to reply when the sudden roar of a jetpack washed over them, and a white armored form, slimmer and smaller than the other battle suits, landed on the ridge with a thump. Two shield drones swept around it, and it bore two fusion blasters, one in each hand. Semaka grunted. He recognized the battle suit easily enough from the briefings they'd been given before making planetfall. It was Shadow Sun herself, come to watch her enemies die in person.
Offhand, old man? I'd say that's why, Jebe said grimly.
The bastion shook, down to its foundations. The ridge trembled with the thunder of alien weaponry. Superheated plasma seared through the cold air and tore great smoking craters in the crumbling outer wall. Snow and shale from the upper reaches of the ridge crashed down, filling the courtyard with an icy mist. Ambergai's snow had proven effective for a few minutes, giving the White Scars a moment's respite, but the Tau gunners had compensated more quickly than the White Scars had anticipated. The White Scars hunkered behind their improvised barricades as the pounding went on and on. One or two of the Space Marines had been hurt, but the barrage wasn't meant to kill them, so much as it was meant to keep them from attacking the Tau as they readied themselves for their next assault. Thirsk crouched, ready to rise as soon as the thunder ceased. Through the ceramite of his gauntlet, he could feel the ground shiver beneath a heavy tread.
Here they come, he said.
He looked over at Ambergai, where the Stormseer sat, head bowed. Manipulating the winds and snows had taken more out of him than he'd admitted.
Are you ready, Stormseer?
Thirsk said softly.
Is anyone ever ready? To wait for readiness is to never move. One can only prepare and seize the moment when it presents itself,
Ambergai said with a tired smile.
Oh, is that a yes?
Thirsk said.
It's as close as you're getting, cousin,
Ambergai said.
Good enough, Thirsk murmured.
A moment later, the outer wall shattered like dropped porcelain. Through the smoke and dust of the explosion, heavy shapes plunged into the courtyard, weapons screaming. A White Scar near Thirsk was erased from sight by a blast that eradicated the section of rubble he crouched behind.
Take them!
He roared, rising to his feet. He grabbed the top of the strong point and threw himself over, axe in hand. Fully half of the remaining White Scars followed him, blades in hand. Some wielded power glaives or swords, but all were armed with hand weapons rather than bolters. They had ammunition to spare, but the shield drones that accompanied the newcomers would simply soak it up. Behind them, the rest of the White Scars opened up with everything they had, distracting the drones, as he'd hoped they would. The enemy constructs were annoying but dumb. They moved to block the incoming fire, and their shields snapped and sparked, lighting up the gloom of the early morning hours. That left only the trio of battlesuits. They were forming the spear point of a second assault. The Xenos were counting on the suits to tear through the Space Marines with the same ease they'd displayed in ripping apart the wall, and, under different circumstances, they might have done so. But Thirsk had fought Orcs and their war machines, and he knew that the power of such a spear was easily blunted and diverted if you kept your head and didn't let the size, speed, or likelihood of your impending messy demise distract you from it. Admittedly, this was harder than it sounded, but if there was one area where the Dark Hunters excelled, it was in killing things that were bigger, louder, and stronger than them. On Phobion, the Sarmatai people who roamed the moonlit plains of the night world fought in silence, for to cry out, even in pain, was to attract the attention of the great bats which hunted the skies on silent wings. Normally, the Nocuros preyed on the herds of pale cannibal horses which roamed the basin plains, but they'd eat a man just as happily, So hunting parties were often formed to clean out those roosts that were too close to human habitation. The Dark Hunters took their name from the beasts, and their tactics, swift, silent, and merciless, from the people who hunted them. Thirsk had only ever seen the bats up close once, and that was when he'd been an aspirant, and sent into the black caverns below Phobian's surface with his squad to baptize their axes in the blood of one of the great savage beasts. That bat, monstrous as it had been, had not worried him as much as the alien battlesuit now loping smoothly towards him. The ground shuddered beneath his feet as it drew close. He set himself and waited.
Breathe. Wait. Strike, he thought.
The words had been drilled into his head as an aspirant.
Haste is the enemy of the Axeman. Strike sure, strike hard, strike again, he thought.
The battlesuit closed in, blade snapping out. The air sizzled as it drove towards him. He lunged beneath the blow, augmented muscle propelling him forward smoothly and swiftly. His axe flashed, chopping through piston and cabling. The battlesuit lumbered past, wheezing and hissing. Smoke boiled out from the point he'd caught with his blow. The battlesuit swung about, eyepiece oscillating and whirring, its guns swung up, humming. Thirsk sprinted towards the wall. Blasts pursued him, ripping up the ground beneath his feet. He leapt. The soles of his boots struck the wall, and he pushed himself off. He flew over the top of the battlesuit as it tried to track him, still firing. His hand snapped out, caught hold of one of the armored plates that protected the top of the construct. He twisted himself around, driving his boots into the back of the battlesuit. Then, rearing up over the top of it, he let his axe fall, shearing off the square head of the suit. The head fell to the ground in a flurry of sparks, and he looked down into the pilot pod, where a blue face, twisted in an alien approximation of surprise, stared up at him. Flipping his axe around, he smashed the haft down on the upraised face, pulping it like rotten fruit. He leapt to the ground as a second suit exploded. The force of the explosion nearly knocked him from his feet, and it was only that half-second without balance that saved him from the energy burst that would have taken his head off. The third suit fought on, with a relentlessness that Thirsk could have admired had it not been trying to kill him. The battlesuit shrugged off the white scars who sought to bring it down, trampling one. Its three-toed foot came down with a crunch on the unfortunate warrior's head, bursting it like a dropped melon, helmet and all. A power glaive sizzled as it left a scar on the battlesuit's hull. The battlesuit spun, backhanding the white scar hard enough to flip him head over heels into the air. The Tau swung around, the fusion blaster boiling the air as it fired. Thirsk threw himself out of the path of the deadly weapon. He hit the ground and rolled to his feet. Axe in both hands, he launched himself at the Xenos, charging towards it. The pilot of the battlesuit was quicker to react than his comrades. He stepped aside as he swatted Thirsk in the back. The blow drove the latter headfirst into a strong point. Head pounding, the Dark Hunter tried to stand. His vision blurred. The air hummed as more battlesuits dropped down into the courtyard. The first three had been the tip. The rest were there to make sure it struck home. Thirsk groped for his axe.
Amber guy, I need you ready,
he croaked, pushing himself to his feet. The battlesuit that had struck him loomed over him, weapon glowing. It fired as he dove between its legs. Smoke and heat washed over him. His power armor felt as if it were responding sluggishly. Something in it might have been damaged. Or maybe it was him. He scrambled to his feet. The battlesuit grabbed his head in a grip that would have crushed his skull had he not been wearing his helmet. It hefted him, and he pounded at its arm helplessly. The metal of his helm began to buckle, and metal cut into his scalp. His eye lenses burst, peppering his face with photosensitive plastics. The world went red at the edges, and then dark. Metal shrieked, and he fell to the ground. He tore the limp fingers of the severed claw from his head and saw Corsaro Khan spring past him. The master of the hunt looked as if he had swum through an ocean of alien blood, but he was laughing as he cut the battlesuit's leg out from under it with one swipe of his power sword, and spun with the blow so that he was facing Thirsk.
"Well done, cousin," Corsaro said. "But the time for the Dark Hunter's way has passed, I think. Now it is time for the Star Hunt to ride."
Behind Corsaro, the battlesuit toppled over. His white scars lunged forward like hounds at the kill. The Dark Hunter tore off his damaged helmet, revealing the pale features and dark scalp lock of his people. Scars marked his cheeks. Not the ritualistic slashes of the white scars, but the crude marks of close fighting.
"I think the Tau would argue that point, my Khan," Thirsk said.
Corsaro turned. The newly arrived battlesuits moved forward, weapons flaring and roaring, sending white scars scrambling for cover. He moved, still smiling, to face them. They had held their position long enough. He knew his enemy's mind now, and that alone was worth the inconvenience and indignity of the trap he'd been led into.
"Storm's here,"
he said, not loudly. His words carried regardless, and he knew Ambergai had heard him.
"My Khan,"
Ambergai said. He stepped out from behind the strongpoint, his staff hugged to his chest. He took a deep breath, and the air was suddenly charged with electricity.
"Command me, my Khan."
Corsaro could hear the faint hint of exhaustion playing about the edge of the Stormseer's words.
"Shake the heavens and scour the earth," Corsaro said.
He swept Moonfang through the air.
"Show them the power of our storm."
"Gladly,"
Ambergai growled. He raised his staff and the air contracted about the ancient relic. It was said that the staves gifted to those brothers who showed an affinity for the Ghost Road were first set into the high plateaus of Trigoris and kissed by the storms, which imparted to them some of their elemental strength. He could feel that strength now, surging around them, coalescing at Ambergai's silent call. Every white scar left felt it as well. It quickened the pulse of their blood and awoke in them the ancient fury which had carried their ancestors from one side of Trigoris to the other, carrying fire and steel to every corner of that wide world. Theirs had always been the way of the storm, the sudden darkness, the crash of thunder, the slash of lightning, the crush of wild snows and heavy rains. Ambergai's necklace of teeth and bells and stormstones rattled as the air grew wet and thick about him. Lightning crawled across the ruined bastion and crept across what was left of the wall in crackling rivulets. It sparked and coiled about the battlesuits, which had ceased their advance. Corsaro knew that the pilots of the large constructs were likely beginning to panic as the storm interfered with their suit systems and prevented them from attacking or retreating. The Tau outside would be seeing the same interference. More than once he had used Ambergai's affinity for the lightning to befuddle their enemy on Agrellon. It wouldn't last long, but the White Scars would make good use of the time the Stormseer bought them. Ambergai was wreathed in lightning. It caressed his power armor like a lover and clutched at his staff. It was only by dint of their long comradeship that Corsaro could detect the faint tremble in the Stormseer's arms. Calling the storm was no conjurer's trick. It required an iron will and a mind sheathed in steel. Ambergai sucked in a deeper breath, and he seemed to swell for a moment. Then, with a roar like one of the ancient stone-barreled cannons of Quan Zhou, he slammed the butt of his staff down and released the gathered lightning. One by one, each of the battlesuits was caught in the storm's talons and began to twitch and shudder as small explosions coursed through them. The lightning swept over them and pulsed out into their enemies beyond the walls, burning the drifts of snow to steam in its passing. The battlesuits, scorched black and gutted, had slumped and were already being covered by the snow which had been stirred by Ambergai's wrath. The Stormseer sank down the length of his staff, sweat dripping from his features. Corsaro sheathed his blade and caught Ambergai as he slumped.
Easy, Sia. Summon your strength, for we have a hard ride ahead of us and no time for rest.
He propelled the Storm Seer towards Thirsk.
Catch him, cousin,
Corsaro said. He turned towards the others.
What are you staring for? The wind calls us. To your bikes, brothers. Our enemy thinks us trapped. She thinks us beaten and broken on the anvil of her cunning. But you cannot hammer smoke, and you cannot trap the lightning.
He flung out a hand.
To your bikes! We shall show our foe the true way of war. Our way.
Thus invigorated, the White Scars raced to their bikes. Thirsk hesitated. Corsaro met his gaze.
You know how to ride?
The White Scars are not the only chapter who use bikes, my Khan, the Dark Hunter said. What of those who cannot ride? He asked.
Corsaro hesitated, his eagerness dimming. There were more white armored bodies lying in the snow than he'd wanted to admit. Not all of them were dead. He was saved from having to reply by Gudi. The Battle Brother still carried his heavy bolter, despite the wound which marked him. A blast from one of the battle suits had ripped one of the shoulder plates from his power armor and torn the latter open, so that sharp protrusions of metal juttered from his blistered and burnt torso and arm. His breathing was ragged, and the difficulty he was having just speaking was obvious.
We die, Dark Hunter,
Godi croaked.
Aye, and gladly. For what good are we if we cannot ride?
He said. It wasn't a question.
We will return,
Corsaro said, laying a hand on Godi's unwounded arm.
Dead or alive, I will come back for you, Hunt Brother, with the full might of the third Mingan at my back.
As you say, my Khan,
Godi said.
Hopefully it'll be the latter. Your swiftness would be appreciated.
He patted the heavy bolter.
I'm almost out of ammunition.
Corsaro had meant what he said. He would come back, if only to collect the gene seed of the fallen. Joking aside, Godi knew as well as he that the likelihood of survival for those staying behind was slim to none. Wounded, low on ammunition, and too far behind enemy lines for easy extraction, they would be forgotten until the war was won or lost. Of the wounded, there were only a few who couldn't ride, or otherwise had volunteered to stay behind. Godi and another hefted the heavy bolters, and the others who could walk were ready to cover their fellows. Those who couldn't move were carried to the gaps in the wall, with as much ammunition as could be spared. The bikes that had no riders were stripped and laid to rest as if they were dead warriors. It pained the White Scars to do so, for each was, if not a relic, then as much a brother of the Ordu as their fellow Space Marines. But even as their ancestors had slaughtered horses which could not be ridden, so would they disable what they could not take with them. Nothing of the chapter could fall into the hands of the enemy. That included the weapons they had stored in the bastion. As he mounted his bike, Corsaro clasped Godi's hand.
You know what to do, he said.
If I live long enough, I'm to blow this cursed place off the ridge,
Godi grunted. Blood ran freely down his armor, plopping onto the ground.
Deny the enemy our dead.
Corsaro nodded shallowly.
Only if it becomes necessary, he said.
Don't worry, my Khan. Self-immolation isn't high on my list of preferred activities, even in good cause,
Godi rasped.
Besides, it's entirely likely that they'll kill us before we get the chance.
Corsaro sat back as his steed growled beneath him. The bike had been still for too long. It yearned to ride, to hurtle forward. He didn't look at Godi.
I'm sorry, brother, he said softly. I led you into death.
Godi shrugged.
And so,
he said,
at least it wasn't boring.
Corsaro nodded and smiled.
No, never that, he said.
Then, with a shout, he gunned the bike's engine. Wheels skidded, and he shot forward, towards the largest gap in the wall. His riders fell in behind him, filling the air with noise. The bolters mounted on the chassis of each bike snarled a hymn of war as they followed him beyond the wall. Only a few minutes had passed since Ambergai had set the lightning on their enemy. The Tau troops were unprepared for the sudden attack. Fire warriors tried to form up around the lightning-addled vehicles, and their impromptu phalanxes were shattered by the hurtling bikes. Corsaro didn't even bother to draw his sword. He extended an arm as he raced past, catching a Tau in the neck and flipping the alien into the air. Godi had followed them out through the wall, and the roar of his heavy bolter, as well as the weapons of the others, followed them as they raced through the ring of Xenos steel that had surrounded the bastion. The ridge trail was blocked by one of the smooth-bodied transports. Corsaro urged his steed up, and the bike's wheels bit into the mottled plates of the vehicle as he rode up over it. His riders followed, shooting and shouting. He steadfastly resisted the urge to look back.
"Onward!" he roared. "For the glory of the Ordu, and for the Khan, and the Khan of Khans!"